طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We have a full feature presentation this morning, and so have to get right to it. In November of 2015, there was a conference at Boston University sponsored by Students for a Just Peace in Palestine that featured Normal Finkelstein and Muin Rabbani, who have co-authored a book together and who both spoke at the conference. Unfortunately, we cannot offer both presentations in one broadcast. Time will not permit. But we want you to hear both scholars, so we'll have Muin Rabbani this week and Norman Finkelstein next week. It is the only way we can do it. We begin with Norman Finkelstein introducing Muin Rabbani at Boston University.
Thank you for coming out this evening. And by good fortune for myself, and I think especially good fortune for you, the audience, by coincidence, my co-author, who I only get to see once every several years, he happened to be in Boston at the same time as me, which is tonight. And a few months ago, we decided that maybe now was the time to not only talk about the awful things that have been happening in Israel-Palestine, but there may actually be the opportunity now to talk about how, for once and for all, to resolve the conflict and to put it behind us. And so I suggested to him, and I was grateful that he agreed, first of all, to write a short book with myself under the modest title, How to Solve the Israel-Palestine Conflict. And then tonight, he was just speaking at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he graciously agreed to come over and do, as it were, a test run of what we're going to be proposing. And I have to say, a lot of what he'll be saying tonight will also be of great interest to me, because I'm not sure exactly what he will be proposing. But I think we're on the same page. The he I'm referring to is Muin Rabbani, and without trying to flatter him and sticking strictly to the facts, I do think, and here I'm not being facetious, he's the shrewdest political analyst on the Israel-Palestine conflict in the world today. There's just nobody who even approaches him in knowledge, in perceptiveness, and I'm not just saying that. That's why I wanted him to co-author the book. And I've said all along to my publisher, if he's not the co-author, I can't do it, because he knows what he's talking about, and he's also very sensible. I can't go through his whole history. I know he because I don't know it, actually. But what I do know is he did attend Tufts University. He then spent some time at Georgetown, if I'm not mistaken. He then worked... to his greatest credit, he was the first executive director of Al-Haq.
No, researcher.
Researcher at Al-Haq, which was the main Palestinian human rights organization, which was very active during the first Intifada, the years 1987 to 1993. And that was roughly the period I first got to know Muin. In more recent times, he headed up the Palestine desk for the International Crisis Group, and now he's a fairly pervasive presence in the Arab media, in particular, analyzing the Israel-Palestine conflict. For those of you who follow Al Jazeera Arabic, he's quite frequently on. And he's also writing. And he'll be the first speaker. Just the order of presentation this evening. Muin will be setting out the general picture, not just as current events, but more importantly, why the current political situation allows for the possibility, if not the certainty, at any rate the possibility, for actually resolving the conflict. I will then try to suggest what should be the goal that we set for resolving the conflict. And then Muin will address, within the context of the goal that we set, he will address the question of the refugees, and I will address the question of the settlements. And once that is done, it'll be an opportunity for everybody here to also step in and have their say, whether in the form of a statement or questions. So having said that, here's Muin.
Thank you, Norm. You did set the bar very low. Just one small correction. I haven't appeared on Al Jazeera Arabic. I don't do live interviews in Arabic because of insufficient mastery of the language. I've done some pre-recorded because those can always be edited and corrected. But anyway, what I'd like to discuss this evening is basically looking at where the region is today and where it might be heading, where the Palestinians are today and where they might be heading, and by way of conclusion, what that may, could, and hopefully can mean for the future of the Palestinian people and a potential resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian and broader Arab-Israeli conflict. I suppose the obvious place to start is by saying that the region is in a state of unprecedented transformation, a revolutionary moment that we haven't experienced since 1958, and that may well, in the months and years ahead, develop into an Arab 1848. Like 1848, it's not something that's going to bring immediate or immediately positive results, but sets in train the prospects of a transformation, of a fundamental transformation of the constitutional order, of the political order, of social and economic order in the region, with the possibility of a more bearable future for the peoples of the region and for their rights. Now, within this transformation, which I probably don't need to describe in too much detail for you, because I suspect many of you have been following it on your television screens and elsewhere, the extraordinary scenes of the popular uprising, first in Tunisia against an autocrat and dictator whom many of us expected to last in power for at least several lifetimes, and then in Egypt, ousting a dictator who was going to remain in power for a second lifetime through the agency of his son, And now, as we've seen elsewhere in the region, throughout the region really, from Morocco in the west to Oman in the east. Within this transformation, which is characterized, let's say, not by military coups and conspiracies within and among the elite, but has been fundamentally characterized by peoples taking to the streets, breaking through the barrier of fear, and challenging their leaders and their intelligence agencies, and even in cases their armies, often with nothing more than bare hands that hold nothing more than banners with slogans. Within this context, we've also begun to see, I think, real changes in the Palestinian arena. To take a step back, the Palestine question since the early 1990s has been dominated by what's conventionally known as the peace process. This began in Madrid at the end of 1991, metamorphosed into the Oslo process and the Oslo framework in September of 1993. And if there's one way to characterize it, it would be that the previous framework of dealing with the Palestine question, which was one in which Palestinians sought to achieve the right of national self-determination on the basis of inalienable rights guaranteed to them by UN resolutions and international law, was transformed into a framework where the Palestinian people were basically transformed into a hamster running in the wheel and never catching the bait. It was one where Palestinians had to prove their worthiness, not even for rights, but even, you know, for basic interests like getting, for example, tax transfers that were already guaranteed to them according to various treaties that they had signed by Israel, which could be either given or withheld at will, almost by royal prerogative. But we had basically a different framework emerging in which Palestinians were placed in the position that they had to consistently, ceaselessly demonstrate that they were eligible for crumbs from the table. These were crumbs that were thrown by the Israelis, but more importantly, there was the all-powerful American arbiter standing in the room who would determine when, where, and how the Israelis should be throwing yet another crumb to the Palestinians. So we had a period of 2 decades of what was conventionally known as the peace process, but which I think is more appropriately termed the consolidation of Israeli occupation on the basis of an ever-deepening process of Palestinian fragmentation. Fragmentation most notably geographically, in which Palestinian authority areas were individually encircled and separated by areas of exclusive control. We had most notably the fragmentation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, whereas until the early 1990s, one could get into a car in the northern West Bank and without too much difficulty drive to the southern Gaza Strip. That became simply impossible, and it became simply impossible in the context of the peace process. And then, of course, also the separation of the West Bank from East Jerusalem, leading to the gradual atrophy of East Jerusalem, because it's a city that is not viable except on the basis of its organic connection to the rest of the West Bank, and that's something that was severed. Now, what we saw in the past several years was not only continuing exponential expansion of Israeli settlements and so on, but growing doubts that a two-state settlement, which was the supposed objective of the Oslo framework that it ever could be achieved. And the reason is that there were three preconditions for a successful outcome. First of all, you would need sufficient international and particularly American pressure on Israel to disgorge the occupied territories. Secondly, you would need an Israeli leadership that was capable of surviving a decision to withdraw from the occupied territories. And third of all, you would need an Israeli capability to actually implement such a decision without, for example, bringing on a military rebellion on its hands. Now, when people look at the rightward shift in Israeli society, the prospects of very widespread insubordination in the ranks of the Israeli military if an order to withdraw from the West Bank would be given and so on, people increasingly concluded that in the absence not only of American pressure, but even the prospect of American pressure on Israel, and the absence of an Israeli government that seemed capable of ever taking a decision to withdraw from the occupied territories, that the days of a two-state settlement were numbered. And I think one need only look at the map to realize why people were increasingly concluding either that a two-state settlement was past tense or that that moment was very rapidly approaching. Having said that, and having myself been one of those who was also coming to that conclusion in recent years, I have to say that the developments over the past year in the region, but also in the Palestinian arena, give real cause for reconsideration and give cause for renewed belief that a two-state settlement, a genuine two-state settlement, not, you know, the Bantustan plus scenario that had been proposed, that could be achieved. And here I think it makes sense to start also by looking at the initiative by the Palestinian leadership to go to the United Nations last September. Now, the background to this has to do with the assumption of office of the Obama administration in January 2009 and the belief among the Palestinian leadership that salvation was at most just around the corner. Obama, in his electoral campaign, had repeatedly spoken of the need to have a fundamentally different relationship with the Muslim world after the Bush years, and had indicated that he saw the need to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as central to that changed relationship. He appointed a Mideast envoy, I think within 36 hours of taking office, rather than, and seemed to be different not only from Bush, but even from Clinton, who waited until the waning days of his second term to engage seriously with this conflict. And there were other signals that to the Palestinian leadership indicated that things were now going to be different, not realizing that the most that could be expected under an Obama administration was a revival of the Oslo process, a process that was all about process and not about peace, in which actually the things that have been seen and denounced as violations of Oslo were not violations of Oslo. Consolidation of occupation, settlement expansion, and so on. Oslo was designed for these things, and there could not be another outcome. So if we fast forward a year, we see a situation in which Obama, having initially been seen as almost a Jesus-like savior by elements of the Palestinian leadership, was increasingly seen as more of a Judas by increasing segments of Palestinian society. And dealing with the process as he proposed it was really one disappointment after another. At the same time, the Palestinians were also dealing with their abiding schism between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, where you had one part of the Palestinian national movement, the Hamas movement, exercising hegemony over the Gaza Strip, and another Fatah exercising hegemony over the West Bank under overall Israeli control. And the leadership in the West Bank felt increasing pressure to do something, to seek an achievement in the context of these internal rivalries. The third element, of course, was the regional transformation that placed enormous pressure on the Palestinian leadership to break with business as usual, because not only their credibility, but their very legitimacy was being called into question. This also had to do with, for example, the collusion of this leadership during the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip in at the end of 2008 and early 2009, the way that the leadership had undermined the Goldstone report at the Human Rights Commission, and so on. So out of this kind of cauldron of disappointment, frustration, popular pressures, and demands for action came the idea of submitting, of going back to the United Nations. The first sign of this was in February of this year, when the Palestinian leadership went to the Security Council to seek a resolution condemning further Israeli settlement expansion. Amazingly, they didn't think that the U.S. would veto it. They genuinely believed that in the context of these of the regional upheaval, Washington would be very wary of vetoing such a resolution, particularly because the text of the resolution was basically a cut-and-paste job from official American statements. Nevertheless, the U.S. did veto the resolution, as might be expected, and this was, I think, for many seen as kind of a death blow to the prospects of a revival of meaningful negotiations with a meaningful agenda. And we then, over the summer, saw a growing move to go towards the United Nations to seek full Palestinian membership in the UN. Now, I think it's important to point out that, unfortunately, this was not done as part of any coherent strategy. There were no real preparations. So, for example, at the end of the day, the Palestinian leadership decided to go to the Security Council rather than the General Assembly. But what we saw is that efforts to lobby the individual Security Council members began not 6 months before submitting the application, but several days or weeks after. And this has to do with kind of the haphazard pattern of policymaking of that section of the Palestinian leadership that undertook this initiative. Nevertheless, I think the key issue here is, or there are two issues here. The first is that, seen from the perspective of those who sponsored the initiative at the UN, internationalizing the question of Palestine and moving away, decisively away, from the Oslo process was never on their agenda. Rather, they were seeking to give the Oslo framework what you might call electric shock therapy, hoping that this would serve as a wake-up call to the Obama administration, in exchange for which the Americans would either, that they would offer something in return. You know, it's kind of one of these hold me back before I kill him kind of things. And it simply didn't work. The Americans turned around and kicked the Palestinians in the teeth. They said they would veto it. They said that the Palestinians would get nothing in return. And if you look at the statement that the quartet gave after the UN, after the Palestinian application was submitted to the Security Council, it proposed a new framework for negotiations that was actually significantly worse than what the quartet had proposed in previous instances, and that's quite an achievement. Nevertheless, I think the more important point is that the move towards the UN has set in motion agendas and processes which have developed beyond the control of those sponsoring that initiative. I think simply by having gone to the UN, the leadership has made it impossible to now return to the negotiating table in the absence of a clear and credible agenda for ending the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. They simply cannot go back to the negotiating table and survive. It would be political suicide for them. Secondly, I think it is, however inadvertently, the beginning of the renewed internationalization of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In other words, it's the beginning of a new process whereby the framework for addressing and resolving this conflict is UN resolutions and international law, rather than basically American officials determining what Palestinians can and can't have based on the process of Israeli needs and interests to the total exclusion of Palestinian rights. This is not going to happen overnight, but I think this move by the Palestinians represents the beginnings of a decisive break with the Oslo process, which can only be for the good. I think it's also the beginnings of the end of the Quartet. Now, for those of you who were unfamiliar with the Quartet was established by the Bush administration in 2002, basically as a substitute for the international community, as a substitute for the United Nations, more or less. And for the past 8-9 years, the Quartet has presented itself as representing the will of the international community. Yet, if we see what has actually happened at the UN in the past few months, it's become clear to everyone that that the positions of the Quartet and that of the planet are actually diametrically opposed, and that they don't complement each other in the least. And thus far, at least, the Palestinians have refused to significantly re-engage with the Quartet on Tony Blair's terms. By way of conclusion, I'd just like to say a few words about what might be next. I think, at least for Palestinians, the absolute precondition for being able to get any advantage out of the current situation, whether these changes in Palestinian strategy, which I've been discussing, or the regional transformation, the absolute precondition is Palestinian national reconciliation, basically a revived Palestinian national movement on the basis of a partnership between the key Palestinian organizations, primarily, of course, Fatah and Hamas, but also others, including not only political movements, but also core constituencies that have, over the course of the past two decades, been completely marginalized in the context of the Oslo process. I'm here thinking primarily of the Palestinian diaspora, but also the Palestinian community within the Green Line. Now, this has to be done on the basis of a common political program. And the common political program that has been all but agreed between these various factions is a two-state settlement based on relevant UN resolutions and international law. Next, Palestinians will need to develop a coherent strategy. As we've seen in the past few months, you can't simply go to the UN and throw in an application and expect any results from it within a matter of days or weeks or even months. It has to be embedded in a coherent strategy which involves preparation, discipline, commitment, but also, and perhaps most importantly, mobilization. Not only the Palestinian people need to be mobilized, but especially now that in a sense, the will of the Arab people is being unleashed by these regional transformations. Arab solidarity needs to be mobilized. And last, but by no means least, International solidarity needs to be mobilized. We've seen, if you look at Europe, for example, there's been a fundamental transformation over the course of the past two decades. We previously used to have a situation in Europe where governments were, to one extent or another, rather neutral on this issue, but European public opinion tended to be strongly pro-Israeli. Well, the situation now is opposite. I mean, and for many sectors of European public opinion, Israel has become more or less a dirty word. Yet, what we've seen during the same period is that European governments have become increasingly pro-Israeli. But there's a lot of work to do here in the sense that there's a lot of activism by Palestinians and solidarity activists on this issue, and it has achieved results, but one need only think of how much greater the results of such activism would be if it was actually sponsored and supported by a genuinely representative national leadership. I mean, you know, one could think of how much longer the South Africans would have had to struggle if, for example, the divestment campaign was not actively supported by the ANC during the 1980s. So just to sum up, my last point, the region now is at a critical historical juncture. I think the most important impact of this transformation is that it has, for the first time in decades, renewed possibility. It's very difficult to tell where things are going to end up, but I think it's equally true that it's not foreordained, that human agency plays a key role here, and how people seek to influence these changes and play a role in these changes will, I think, be fundamental to where these changes will end up. Thank you.
That was Mouin Rabbani's main presentation at the BU conference, and we now want to continue it with his follow-up on the right of return.
Thank you. I don't pretend to bring any moral authority to bear on this question, and I also have never been, just to get this out of the way, I've never been particularly enthusiastic about identity politics. I'd like to make a few remarks about the refugee question and the two-state settlement, just based on my own interest and involvement in the matter. I think it's important to first take a step back and recall the origins of the Palestinian refugee question. On November 29th, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly, which was in a very different General Assembly and did not yet include Palau or Micronesia, or I think over 100 of the other states that would subsequently join it, adopted a resolution recommending the partition of Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. This resolution, as you know, was immediately and emphatically rejected not only by the Arab population of Palestine, but indeed by the entire Arab world for what were and remain, I think, entirely justifiable reasons, which is that the General Assembly presumed to give sovereignty over 50% of Palestine to the Jewish immigrant population, which had in its vast majority settled there during the previous decades under basically British rule, and controlled only 7% of the land of Mandatory Palestine and formed more or less only 50% of the population of that portion of Palestine which was allotted by the General Assembly to a Jewish state. I think it's also important to note that when the General Assembly recommended the establishment of a Jewish state in part of Mandatory Palestine, it never intended to in any way authorize the ethnic cleansing of that portion of Palestine. Yet what we saw was the immediate beginning of conflict, first a civil conflict within Mandatory Palestine until the 15th of May 1948 between the two communities, and then after the State of Israel was proclaimed on the 15th of May, an interstate conflict between the newly established state and the surrounding ones. During that conflict, 90% of the Arab population of those parts of Palestine, which became the State of Israel, were essentially ethnically cleansed from their territory, from their homes, from their villages, and so on. 90% of, not the 50% of Palestine that was allotted to the Jewish state, but rather the 78% of Palestine that became Israel. And I think the key issue to understand about the refugee question is it's not so much a question of whether people fled as a precaution, were expelled, or fled in terror. The key issue here is that at the conclusion of the war, none of these refugees, in many cases people not yet realizing that they were refugees, were permitted to return to their homes. And already in December of 1948, the General Assembly adopted a further resolution, 194, according to which Palestinians were provided the right of return. The exact wording of the resolution is something along the lines of all Palestine refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be allowed to do so and should be compensated also for damages and loss of property and so on. That was in 1948. What we've had over subsequent decades is now a situation where the majority of Palestinians today, including the majority of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and something between 30% and 40% of Palestinians in the West Bank, and including a very sizable proportion of Palestinians who were Israeli citizens, are in fact dispossessed, uprooted refugees. Now, how does one go about addressing this issue, and more importantly, how does one go about addressing this issue in the context of a two-state settlement? Well, there is a view that there is, at some level, a fundamental contradiction between the right of return and a two-state settlement. My view is that the key to unlocking the supposed contradiction and that the key to the resolution of the Palestinian refugee question lies in an explicit and unambiguous recognition of the right of return of dispossessed and uprooted Palestinian refugees and descendants. In other words, I feel that it's my view that if this right is not recognized, this issue can and will never be resolved. And I'd also like to point out that when we speak of a two-state solution on the 67 borders, it's often forgotten that the core of this conflict, and in my view, the most vexing issue, if you will, one that is more emotive and more existential than the issue of settlements, than the issue even of Jerusalem, is the issue of is the Palestinian refugee question. And we've had a variety of formulas over the years. For example, the Geneva Accords of, this was an informal peace negotiation held between a variety of Israelis and Palestinians about 10 years ago, and came up with this formula, and the conclusion of which was that, you know, Palestinians will not have the right of return, and I can't remember the exact wording, and Israel will not recognize it, but this will be seen as the implementation of 194. It's something akin to an agreement in 1995 reached between Mahmoud Abbas, the current Palestinian president, and a liberal Israeli politician, Yossi Beilin, where they resolved the question of Jerusalem by basically saying that the future Palestinian state would be given sovereignty over a village on the outskirts of Jerusalem named Abu Dis, but that it would be renamed Al-Quds, which is the Arabic name for Jerusalem, and that thereby the Palestinian capital would be in Jerusalem, and that would resolve the question of Jerusalem. Well, I think the key issue to understand is that you can't resolve the Palestinian refugee question with smoke and mirrors. The core of any resolution has to be an explicit Israeli recognition of the right of return and of its direct responsibility for causing and perpetuating the Palestinian refugee question. Once that's been done, then I think a negotiated resolution of this question becomes possible, including one that the vast majority of Palestinians, including Palestinian refugees, would be prepared to accept as a just resolution of the refugee question. Absent an explicit Israeli recognition of responsibility and of Palestinian rights, I simply don't see how that could be achieved. Now, if we get into specifics of what will this look like on the ground, I think it's easier to determine what won't work than to determine what will work. For example, there was a proposal at some point during the brief period in which Israelis and Palestinians sought to negotiate the so-called permanent status issues, in which it was said that the right of return would be subject to Israeli sovereign discretion, and that only Palestinians who physically resided in their home villages prior to 1948, presumably without their direct descendants and families, would be allowed with very restricted criteria and so on. That's not going to work. Perhaps a formula in which all Palestinians still alive who resided within what is now Israel, including any of their descendants who would like to return, that might possibly be something that many, perhaps most Palestinians would be prepared to accept. There is another issue here, which is the question of compensation. And here I would like to just make one brief point, which is that I do not think that refugee rights can be purchased with financial compensation, particularly if any fund that is established to compensate Palestinian refugees is an international fund led by the U.S. or the EU or the World Bank or whatever. I think the party that is directly responsible for Palestinian dispossession and for having perpetuated the Palestinian refugee question over the past 60 years has to be a leading and direct participant in any compensation scheme. Now, if Israel were to get money from the Americans or Europeans or whatever, that's a different question. But the idea that somehow a Palestinian refugee would be compensated by Denmark rather than by Israel is something that, in my view, simply won't fly. So, unfortunately, I do not have very clear ideas or very specific ideas on what a resolution would look like. I do have very clear ideas on what a resolution will not look like, about what won't work. It does, however, remain my conviction that a explicit recognition of the right of Palestinian refugees and explicit recognition of Israeli responsibility will make a negotiated resolution, in other words, a resolution that is acceptable to both parties and, most importantly, acceptable to the vast majority of Palestinians, including Palestinian refugees, that will then become possible. Thank you.
You have been listening to Middle East scholar and author Muin Rabbani speaking at Boston University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be by scholar and author Norman Finkelstein speaking at the conference at Boston University on where we go next in the Palestine-Israel conflict. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.